Welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, a work of the Jesuits in Britain. I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s and I used to live in a Jesuit young adult community. We all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you to take a moment to stop and think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. Every week I meet a new guest who tells me about something they experienced which changed their life forever. By talking about the things they wish they'd known, we'll explore the idea that God is in all things. And we'll talk about the part that faith plays in navigating life's challenges. This week, we're continuing the conversation with Lauren. Last time, Lauren shared about her experience of addiction and her journey to sobriety. Today, she explains how addiction can happen to anyone. I think I want to go back to the question that I asked earlier. We live in a society, and I know you said earlier we change, it's changing, and yeah. It's less about drinking. But I want to ask, how challenging is it to be sober in a culture where there's that kind of encouragement of drinking?
Yeah, it is challenging, but I've got a really solid group of friends, and I explain what I need quite clearly. So, for example, if I say I'm leaving, like a party or, you know, something, we're clear, they never do that whole, oh no, just stay for another half hour, whatever, you know, which is always comes from a nice place. They want your company, right? Yeah. I've said that is not helpful for me. And they don't do that. They just, okay, let me know when you're home safe. And that's it. And little things like that, little changes like that, just allow me to socialize in a way that takes the pressure off me. Often, if I'm socializing, I'd say that there's three phases to a night and I enjoy phase two only and I leave before, you know, anything else. So if I'm like at a work Christmas do or, you know, something like that, you really never know, you know, how messy these things are going to get. The first phase of the night where you kind of end up is all a bit awkward and you're sort of pinned into sort of conversation and you can't really move very well. And
I really hate that.
That's the worst bit, isn't it? It's like no one's really loosened up yet. Then there's a second bit where people have kind of eased into it. The people who drink have maybe had one or two drinks, but actually there's really fun conversations. People are laughing, maybe even a bit of dancing, whatever. And then there's a third bit, and that's where, you know, someone's gotten a bit sloppy. Someone said, they just love you. I can't believe you're doing this without drinking. You're amazing. I'm gone before that bit. You know,
that is good advice.
I'm a phase two partier only. I turn up 1 hour after the invite says, and I am gone before midnight because I like my sleep and I like the rest. But actually, you know, I'm 37 now. So the sort of makeup of socializing, it's far more dinner parties than nightclubs these days. So actually it is a bit more manageable. And most people know that I don't drink. So there's often like an alcohol-free option available. But sometimes it can be a little uncomfortable. It depends.
I was just thinking about the alcohol-free. I think we've also got a lot more wide range of alcohol-free these
Massively.
Days. Where I think it used to be like, you can have orange juice or water.
Yeah, totally. And the alcohol-free options, Schlur. Christians love Schlur. It's absolutely everywhere. But often they're really sweet and sugary. And sometimes you don't really fancy that. So then your option is water. Whereas these days there are a few more options which like kind of like grown-up soft drinks, which don't quite have the same amount of sugar, or like a really nice flavored water or something. So yeah, that's fun. There's more to play with. It's not just like you say, orange juice or a can of Coke.
In my mid-20s, I was reading an article that was talking about addiction and how we've all probably got a tendency to be addicted to something.
Yeah.
And it was saying about if you can't give up alcohol for 6 months, then you need to think that you might have a problem. And so I'm not saying this is the right thing to do, but at that stage, I was like thinking about it to myself. So I was like, oh, I can give up alcohol for 6 months. And then I actually was like, but then I've got this social event and then I've got that social event and things. And then at that point I was like, do you know what? I'm going to do it for 6 months and just prove to myself that I don't have an addiction.
Yeah.
So then how do you know if you do or don't have an addiction?
Yeah, that's interesting. I do often hear people say like, oh, I've done dry January. So I've done a whole month. I'm obviously in a really good place with alcohol. Therefore, I totally disagree. You know, I don't think that that's really a good metric of anything. I think one measure is probably not a good measure. And when you scale it up from 1 month to 6 months, you are getting there, you know, when I have people come to me and they have got a number of signs that I would consider to indicate that they're drinking in a problematic way, that suggests that they could be addicted to alcohol, I'll say do a year. I'm like, do a full year from now and let me know how you get on. And that's also what sort of the literature around Alcoholics Anonymous would suggest. Like, just give it a year and notice yourself and see how you're doing. I still would say that using one measure isn't particularly helpful. If somebody's concerned, there's a test online. It's called an audit test, A-U-D-I-T. I can't remember what that stands for. But an audit test, and that has got several questions that looks at all the different elements of your drinking and the way that you consume alcohol, and then will give you an indication. I think anyone who thinks they might need to take it will probably be told that they are drinking in a problematic way. I think you know. I think that deep down, you know if alcohol is causing problems for yourself, for your relationship with your friends, with your family, with God, with your community, with your work, then it's a problem. If someone in your life has suggested that alcohol is a problem, that needs to be taken seriously as well. I know we can sort of dismiss people. They don't know. They're not here the whole time. Actually, if someone who really cares about you says, I'm worried, doesn't mean that you're drinking alcoholically, but it does need to be taken seriously. I don't think people do that lightly. I think if you're spending money you don't have on it, if you're finding that you're losing days, if you're finding that it is becoming a barrier, if you're sitting at the dinner table and you're looking at the one bottle of wine in the middle of the table and you're thinking that's not going to be enough, where are we going to get more alcohol from? If it's distracting from the time and the company, there are questions to ask yourself around that, you know? But I think that looking at all the different questions together will help you build a good picture. And to do that, I would suggest just giving a Google to that audit test and seeing how many of those questions kind of raise a red flag for you.
So since you've got sober, you've done your degree in neuroscience and your master's in addiction studies, which I'm going to come back to, but it kind of links to what you've just been saying for my next question, which is I've once told somebody or had an honest conversation where I think they might have a problem with alcohol, and one of their parents does have a problem with alcohol. Mm. And so then there was the question is it genetic or is it a personality or some other trait?
Yeah.
Is it that more likely?
Yeah. There's no question that addiction is heritable. That is absolute. No one in addiction research is still researching that because it is so well established and agreed. And it was in the 1970s. And it kind of blows my mind that that hasn't seeped out more. Some people seem to know, but actually it's not common knowledge in the public sphere in the way that it is in addiction research. And it really surprises me. It is 50% heritable, but it is important to note that your genes are not your destiny, right? But you will have, or you may have, a more of a predisposition towards addiction if you're a person who can see it in their family, right? And there's conversations to be had by people who are far better theologically trained about sort of generational, sort of the handing down of these things from generation to generation in a spiritual sense. And I definitely think that praying and putting protective measures in place and breaking those kinds of ties, there's spiritual work to be done there. But also, you know, if you're just looking at the science, where obviously they don't talk about that kind of stuff at all, if you're just looking at the science, then genetically you can inherit genes that make you more vulnerable. And that is good to be aware of because it means that you can put more protective measures around yourself. And basically, I mean, there's lots of research, there's lots of science around sort of the things that will protect you. Going to church, being an active part of a church community in young adults is a protective measure. Not being in a family environment where drug and alcohol use happens, where, you know, if you're in a family environment, there's lots of arguing, that's also potentially damaging. Having a peer group who use drugs is a big predictor of later addiction. You know, ultimately, There are lots of things that create a sort of unstable home environment for you. This is in young people, in adolescents, that could mean that you're more predisposed to an addiction. And these things compound as well, because if you have a family member who has got a genetic predisposition to addiction and then starts drinking or using drugs, of course they're creating an unsafe family environment for you. So then you've got potentially the genes as well as the unsafe family environment. But I think, you know, it's when trauma and pain that is unprocessed, unexpressed, and poorly understood meets, you know, potential genetics. But also there are plenty of addicts who have no family history of addiction. You know, it's not a one size fits all situation, but there is that element. Yes.
So going back to your degree and your master's.
Yeah.
Did you feel that God was using your experience to lead you into supporting others?
Yeah, for sure. So I was maybe two years sober when I set up a Christian recovery program from my church in West London. And that was for anyone who was struggling with any kind of addiction. So we had a lot of people come for sex and pornography addiction, which we don't talk enough about as Christians. I mean, we kind of talk about it a bit, but we kind of focus on men. It's women too. And we've got this weird sort of like ranking hierarchy system where people kind of believe that that involves more shame, which I completely refute. It's just a different tool that people have gone to, you know, fine. Like anyone can end up with any addiction. You know, there's no ranking system. And for some people, that's where they found their comfort or they found their quick fix. There's some definite barriers for people in that position to sort of seeking help because of that sort of stigma, which I think is just so wrong. So we got lots of people who are struggling with that. We got lots of people with drug and alcohol. We got people who were struggling with food addiction, with codependency, with love addiction, all kinds of people coming through. And what I found was, I understood the 12-step process very well. And that is steeped in Christianity and biblical wisdom and Jesus teachings, even if it's not explicitly said these days. It was initially, but it's not these days because it has to be open to people regardless of their beliefs. I totally, totally see that. But so I'm very aware of that, very aware of the stories I was hearing. I could see patterns myself, but anecdotally and through these connections and these people I knew. But I just felt like if I'm going to actually step up and help people, I've got to understand this more. I've got to have a bit more credibility. So that's when I went and did the master's at King's and learned more about the sort of therapeutic response, about the way that drugs work in our system, and a bit as well about the sort of behavioral addictions, but it was mainly based on the sort of chemistry of it.
So how do neuroscience and faith intersect in your understanding of addiction?
I mean, God created our brains, right? And I don't think, certainly not in any of our lifetimes, we're actually ever going to really understand the interaction between mind and brain and thoughts and chemistry. And it is just such a spectacular thing. Like what I understand of it, what people who've studied it for years and years and years, their whole lifetime more than me understand of it, is like the tiniest fraction. But there are things that are really quite spectacular. Like, you know, in the Bible, when it talks about the renewing of your mind, And we see that in science. We see that in neuroscience. We see that you can create these deep addiction pathways, this deep response to these behaviors or substances in your brain, but there is space for the renewal of your mind. And God's built in this kind of like neural plasticity is the sort of like the neuroscientific term for it, where your brain operates based on what you repeat. And he says, come back to me. Pray, sit with me, read the Bible, do these things. These things are going to bring you peace. And that is absolutely supported by the science, you know? So what you choose, the choices you make become the way you think, right? And the whole point, the reason why priests and your church leaders, they want you to exercise that discipline is they know it is shaping your mind in a way that will protect you and bring you closer to God. And it really, really will, you know?
So earlier, you spoke when you first got sober of just making it through the day.
Yeah.
And I spend quite a bit of my time now talking about going on silent retreats because I love a silent retreat. And the first time I did it, I wasn't ready for, like, well, I was, but I was kind of that person of like, I don't want to sit in silence. How am I going to do 8 days? Well, 6 days. And that actually wasn't my problem. And it's now quite often the problem that people bring up to me is like, but how do you deal with not having your phone? And I remember on the 6 day retreat, I had a piece of paper where I put a mark on each day when I got through the end of the day of not turning my phone on. Because, and I think that must be quite a common addiction now that we all have like smartphones as well.
Yeah. My goodness. Yes. If you want to know what it feels like for an addict who wants their drug of choice, leave your phone at home. And every time you touch your pocket, that is a indication of the physical pain that an addict is in each time. And my goodness, do we all relate to that? We are, you know, like you were saying earlier, we are built to worship, right? We are built to adore. We are built to idolize, but there's one place where that is supposed to be directed. That is Jesus. That is God, right? But when you misdirect your attention, your adoration, you know, that's in that idolatry space, right? I think right at the top of that scale of idolatry is addiction, where it's completely out of control. But then there's the notches in between. Say it's on a scale of 1 to 10. If I asked you to get, you know, draw that scale out on a piece of paper and I'm like, right, money, where's your relationship with money? Is Jesus fully on the throne? You are happy to give away, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Or actually, is there a little part of you that's still like, oh, can I trust you with this? Alcohol, your relationship with food, your relationship with people around you, your relationship with your phone. I think very few people would in all faith be able to put lower than a 7 on the relationship with their phone. I know, it's grim.
Oh, no. I'm thinking I would have gone for a 5.
You would have been a 5?
No. I'm saying like, actually, no, ignore that. I've realized my brain hadn't processed what you meant. You're right, 7.
I think somewhere between 7 and 10 for phones, pretty much universally. Yeah. What we have in our pocket is a weapon formed against us to distract us from all that is good. And you can use it for good things. You know, I've got my Bible verse memorizing app, which is so helpful. And actually the gamification of that does, you know, play into how I work best. And it means that I can recite verses like never before because this app is like design. It's almost like the Bible Candy Crush, like giving me little rewards every time I remember a verse. You know, you can find good uses for it. And there are amazing, you know, resources that can go on your phone. But actually, you know,
it's only adding to the use of your phone, which only adds to the addiction.
They did a study with students and found that like they were, I can't remember the exact figures, but infinitely more likely to pass a test if they worked with books and notepads and pens than if they worked on a screen. You just take things in so much more. Lots of churches now are really encouraging people to bring their physical Bible back and not just grab their phone to pull out the verse, you know, during the service or whatever.
I found that when I was doing my master's that I needed to print stuff off to like take it in.
Yeah.
I can never read it on a screen.
Yeah.
So are there any common misconceptions that like frustrate you?
There's an idea that an alcoholic is somebody who's like on a park bench, rough sleeping, hasn't shaved, smells terrible, got their brown bag of booze, you know, and actually alcohol addiction, but any addiction can affect anyone. They can be incredibly well presented. They can be wealthy. They can be, you know, it just makes no difference. It's the great leveler, you know, religion, race, culture. It doesn't matter. We can find it so easy to slip into these patterns. And sometimes, you know, you're sort of just up that scale of idolatry and you need to regroup. And sometimes it's absolutely out of control. And I think that people discount themselves and think like, well, I can't be an addict. I've got this, this, and this. And really, like, really, I think that there's a bit of a humility piece, like how easily it could be you, and how much care people shouldn't be dismissed, maybe because it doesn't look like what you think. And actually, you know, research suggests that 1 in 10 of us are struggling with an addiction. So, you know, if you go to a church with 100 people, there'll be 10 people there who are really battling something, you know?
So what piece of advice would you give to someone who's praying through about quitting?
I think if something is really taking over that much of your attention and that much of your time, your money, your headspace, your relational space that you could be giving in good, positive places, then you could give up one thing in exchange for everything. And I've found it hard, but there is not a moment where I regret making that decision. It is the proudest thing I ever did in my life. And I don't live in shame anymore. I don't live dreading challenge or questions or wondering what lie I've told and how to cover it up. I don't sit in church and think like, oh, you know, that's for me. You know, obviously I do. There are still things that are for me, but not to that sort of deep, like, I'm just so getting this wrong. You know, I get to be proud of myself. I'm asked to be godparent to people's children. I see the change that my story has in other people. And I get to do that. And I get to do that with God. And I think if you're wondering about starting on that journey, absolutely do it. I can't, even if actually what you're working with isn't an alcohol addiction, but just sometimes it gets a bit problematic, your life will not be better with it. You know, like, it just won't. I'd so encourage you to take that step. And I think particularly if you are dealing with an addiction, you cannot do that on your own. Reaching out, finding a support group, an anonymous fellowship or a charity or something where somebody understands what it is to go through that and can be a support and to have those conversations. I think asking for help is the most powerful thing you can do.
So what do you wish you knew about sobriety and addiction?
I wish I knew that it's not just weakness. And I think when I was younger, you know, I had a friend who really struggled with depression. And I remember thinking like, oh, just get over it. Like, both your parents, like, okay, they were separated, they were divorced, but they loved her. They were super present. She had a lovely house, you know, nice food. She went to a nice school. She had friends. It was like, come on, like, what's the big deal? And then when it came to addicts, I would see someone who was struggling and messing everything up. And I'd just be like, just stop, just pull it together, just stop. And I wish I had understood that whilst I completely acknowledge I'm the person who made the decision to take cocaine the first time I took it, right? And like, no one forced that on me. And there may be instances where things are forced on people, but for me, no, I made that choice and that is on me. But actually, by the time I realized how important it was to make the right choice, my ability to do so was gone. And I just didn't understand the absolute desperation and lack of self-control that comes from addiction. And I've had people come to me whose parents have died from addiction and they've said, like, why couldn't he or she just choose me? Why was it that rather than being my mom or dad, they chose to keep taking drugs and now they're gone? And that is just not the choice that an addict is facing. The choice that they're facing is so, it's not that they go like, right, what do I love most? Where am I going to invest? There's no rationality about it. You are absolutely caged. You're completely trapped, completely desperate, with vague understandings of the pain that you're causing people around you, but actually just so one-track minded. And the pain and desperation of that is really quite extreme. And I didn't understand that. And I think that when people say, like, you know, or oh, get it together, or act as if it's sort of a moral failing or a choice, while there are elements of choice, actually, like, these people, and I was just completely lost. And I wish I'd understood that more and been more sympathetic towards it before it happened to me.
So what are you grateful for?
Gosh. Do you know, there are obvious things like my faith and Jesus and the fact that I understand I understand so much more about how to healthily process things and how to be in a good place. And I've got amazing community, and I feel that through faith, I've got purpose and identity in a way that I didn't understand before. And I'm super grateful for that. I'm super grateful for sobriety. But even when I was saying earlier, like the fact that people ask me to be a godparent to their children, you know, like I don't have any children of my own, but I'm godmother to 5 boys. And they're just like, someone believes that I am going to show up for them, pray for them, you know, be a reliable spiritual guide and support and fun aunt, or, you know, like turn up and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And that, and someone's gone like, that's someone I want my child to be influenced by. Can you imagine a greater accolade than that? You know, like, I was a drug addict. No one would leave me alone with it. No self-respecting parent would leave me alone with their child. And now people are like, you've got something that you can impart on my child that I want them to have. That is like, blows my mind every time.
Thanks for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. I know this episode is going to stay with me because it made me think about how what we feed into our brains is what our brains output. How about you? We'd love to hear how Lauren's story resonates with you. And why not also tell us if you're facing an experience you wish you knew how to look at differently? It might just be something we can help with. You can find out more about this and other themes at thinkingfaith.org. Thank you again for listening. I hope you'll join me again next time on Things I Wish I Knew.